The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazines. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from theteenmagazine.com and teenvogue.com. Our first article today from teenvogue.com, The Adultification Bias Leaves Black Girls Vulnerable. Can we finally fix it? This article was written by Chanel Dupree on September 12th, and there is a note. In this op-ed, filmmaker Chanel Dupree and Me Too International's Jasmine Wilson examine the adultification bias against black girls and why they're left vulnerable to harm. Me Too International recently released a PSA on this topic in connection with their recent campaign, What Do We Owe Black Children? While school boards ban books and shut down honest conversations about race and gender, another silence takes hold, the quiet adultification of black children, especially black girls. Black girls are often both hypervisible and invisible, constantly watched, rarely understood. And in schools across the country, they face undue punishment that can impact their future potential. This is all because black girls are commonly viewed through a racist and misogynistic lens, one that encourages adults around them to treat them as fellow adults, not the children that they are. When black girls are not recognized as children, their whole experience of childhood is rewritten in ways that come with deep consequences. This systemic denial of their girlhood shows that childhood is not a fixed or universal experience. Childhood is a concept largely shaped and given meaning by the adults who surround children. For many, meanings and roles are assigned before a child is even born. Some expectant parents have already decided that their child will be unruly or troublesome, and some even predict their sexual behavior or sexuality before they have even taken their first steps. He's going to be a heartbreaker, or you got to watch that one, she's going to be a problem. Jokes about harsh discipline, silencing children, or asserting parental dominance are routinely woven into everyday conversation and equate to a loss of innocence. For black girls, this loss of innocence is not theoretical. It's measurable. According to a report from Georgetown Law's Center on Poverty, as early as age 5, black girls are more likely to be seen as older, more mature, and less in need of comfort, protection, or guidance than their peers. This perception, known as adultification bias, follows them into classrooms, playgrounds, and every institution that shapes their lives. In schools, it means that curiosity can be mislabeled as defiance, energy is read as aggression, and emotional expression is punished instead of nurtured. By the time they reach adolescence, this bias mutates into a dangerous label. Black girls are stigmatized as fast, even as the violence they face escalates, according to the National Black Women's Justice Institute. The cruelest part? These harms are framed as personal flaws rather than evidence of a broken system. This bias is not new. It is rooted in a long history of violence and control. During slavery, black women were denied bodily autonomy and legally excluded from the category of womanhood. They were often hypersexualized to justify rape and simultaneously cast as immoral to deny them the protections white women received. These same logics rooted in misogynoir, a unique discrimination that affects Black women and girls, continue present day and inform how Black girls are perceived in contemporary society. Black girls are not safe when the world sees them as women before they're even allowed to be children. Time and again, society places the burden of safety and survival on their backs, expecting them to self-police, shrink, and obey unwritten, ever-changing rules that were never designed to protect them in the first place. Don't wear that. Don't talk like that. Don't be too loud. Don't be too grown. We have created a world where Black girls are expected to be fearful of the dangers around them. But too often, we also teach them to be fearful of themselves. This raises a crucial question. Are we genuinely trying to protect them, or just projecting our fears onto them? We are all aware of how cruel the world can be toward Black girls, and many adults seem to believe that by policing Black girls' bodies or behaviors, they are preparing them for the worst. Yet, when the warnings are framed as blame or personal fault, projection replaces protection. Instead of guiding them through the realities of the world, we risk teaching them that their very existence is the problem. Let's be clear. Black girls do not need to be more respectable to be protected. They don't need to say things the right way, wear the right clothes, or prove they're worthy of care. Adults need to stop demanding that Black girls perform goodness in order to prove that they're worthy of safety and protection. It's on us, not them, to dismantle the rules of rape culture. We must ask ourselves, do you believe Black girls are responsible for the harm perpetrated against them? If the answer is no, as it should be, then one critical piece of the puzzle is how we communicate with and about them. Shifting our message is not the only action required, but it is a powerful step in creating the conditions where Black girls are seen, valued, and protected. For example, if a girl has been harassed on the street for what she is wearing and seeks support from an elder, the lesson should never be, "This is what you get for dressing that way." Instead, it should be, "You did nothing wrong. You are allowed to wear whatever makes you feel beautiful. Let me explain why the world reacted this way and how you can maintain your self-worth and sanity throughout this journey." Showing up for Black girls also means shifting blame off children and squarely onto the systems and adults that fail them. It means educators intervening when a student is being groomed, not just when she violates dress code. It means journalists and people in the media refusing to recycle harmful and, frankly, old and tired stereotypes. It means interrogating our own biases and demanding policy and cultural change that centers healing and justice, not punishment and control. Confronting your internal biases can start with one honest question. How can I show up better for Black girls? Sit with the discomfort, listen deeply, and let the answer change the way you speak, act, and advocate. We say we care about Black girls. It's time to prove it. Not with more conversations about how they can survive the world as it is, but by building a world where they no longer have to. Black girls, don't let this world gaslight you into believing that your voice is too loud, your body is too grown, or your dreams too impossible. Don't let institutions convince you that your pain isn't real, or that your brilliance must be dimmed to make others comfortable. You are not too much. You are exactly enough. Every instinct you have to question, to resist, to demand better for yourself is a reflection of your power. Hold tight to that power, because the very fact that people try to deny it is proof of how unstoppable you are. For more information about dismantling adultification, check out Me Too International's PSA, The Rules. Our next article from TeenVogue.com. Raven Simone on Child Stardom's Lingering Effects. I Have Certain Masks. This article was written by Ashley Carter on September 20th, and there is a note. The actor and That's So Raven star joined Alison Stoner and Miranda Madej at Teen Vogue Summit to discuss the complicated impact of child stardom. Raven Simone, Alison Stoner, and Miranda Madej are all well-versed in child stardom and the toll it takes on young people. The trio joined Teen Vogue's Associate Culture Director P. Claire Dodson in a wide-ranging discussion at Teen Vogue Summit 2025 in Los Angeles. Together, the entertainers opened up about coming of age in the spotlight, navigating being a positive influence at such a young age, and how they're thriving in their careers now. Despite the complexities of child stardom, particularly in the early 2000s, Raven candidly said, "It builds character." The actor started working as a baby and learned early on how to keep things private, including relationships. Raven's wife, Miranda Madej, said she's learned a lot from Raven when it comes to privacy and dealing with the nasty comments. "It's disgusting," Raven said of the comments. Stoner also took the time to show empathy for Madej and Raven in regards to the hate comments they receive online. "I'm so sorry that you are even spoken to like that," Stoner said. Stoner described being a young actor as a bizarre fishbowl of having folks perceive you while you're still a child. "I found myself wrestling a lot in the middle of it," they continued. "It was a dissonance where I wanted to be a positive role model, but I also didn't know what I was doing yet." Madej echoed that statement, saying she grew up around a lot of famous children in L.A. and realized that acting is just a job, not who people are in totality. "At the end of the day, we're all people," she said. Raven has always had to navigate fans conflating fictional roles with reality. "There was no personal social media to really differentiate between who I was at home and who I was on camera," Raven said. "I've always known that I have certain masks to get through for people to see me." Stoner said this is often difficult to navigate. "We're compartmentalizing pieces of ourselves, and we're playing with what is safe to express, especially those of us who are queer or gender nonconforming or entering spaces that aren't always the safest choice for our personal safety," they said. Now that Stoner is older, they've said they've let go of certain things they've been accustomed to with acting for so many years, including wearing makeup. They described being told they look sloppy or not presentable without it, and how it's been freeing to let that go. "I show up without makeup, and I know those comments are going to say, 'Allison looks tired. Allison looks so old.' But no, that's what former child labor looks like on my body," Stoner said. "Did you work 25 years straight, literally, with no breaks?" Raven Simone is best known for a breakout role in the early 2000s on Disney Channel's popular series, That's So Raven. The actor's physical comedy and larger-than-life talent made Raven a standout on the channel and led to 4 seasons of the series from 2003 to 2007. Raven later starred in the Disney Channel original movie, The Cheetah Girls, as a member of the Rising Girl group. But Raven had been acting long before Disney, first starring in The Cosby Show at just 3 years old, and later acting in films such as The Little Rascals, Dr. Dolittle, and Xenon, Girl of the 21st Century. Outside of acting work, Raven has also released 4 albums, co-hosted The View, and now has a podcast with wife Miranda Madej called Tea Time with Raven and Miranda. Allison Stoner is also an actor, author, and activist who got their start at an early age on Disney Channel in multiple franchises, including Mike's Super Short Show, That's So Raven, The Sweet Life of Zack and Cody, and more. Stoner later starred in major blockbusters like Cheaper by the Dozen and Step Up. But what made Stoner a standout was their dance abilities. The performer starred in multiple music videos and as a backup dancer in the early aughts, including for big artists like Missy Elliott, Eminem, Outkast, and more. Now, Stoner advocates for child actors, the LGBTQ+ community, and has contributed to programming at the United Nations and the World Health Organization. Miranda Madej is a Los Angeles-based public relations and entertainment manager expert who started out as an assistant and worked her way up in the industry. While she is a writer, podcast host, and producer, Madej is also a doula with a passion for women's health. She also co-founded I See Pictures with her wife, Raven. Our next article from the teenmagazine.com, The Big Bang Theory. Is it truly the explanation behind our universe's origin? This article was written by Anya Dow on September 2nd. Although technology and science are rapidly advancing, what we don't know about the universe far exceeds what we do know. One thing scientists have been theorizing about for decades is the formation of the universe. The Big Bang Theory, which you've almost definitely heard of, is the best known theory we have at the moment, but it's far from a proven fact. Here's an explanation of the Big Bang, along with why it's a theory, not a fact. A quick overview. A very simplified explanation of the Big Bang is this. Essentially, around 14 billion years ago, it's thought that the universe was an infinitely dense, small and hot point, which then rapidly expanded. Here the name is somewhat misleading. There was no grand explosion, but rather an expansion, and cooled down, allowing for the formation of matter and everything we know. Evidence for the Big Bang Theory. A fundamental piece of evidence for this theory is redshifting. Redshifting occurs when an object in space, like a galaxy, is moving away from us, and therefore the light wavelengths this object emits become more stretched out, causing them to shift toward the red side of the visible light spectrum. Think of it as similar to a car zooming past you. The further away it moves, the lower the pitch of the sound, and the less you hear. Redshifting applies a similar concept, but to light, not sound. As an object moves away from us, the light wavelengths become stretched out and red, Just like how when a car zooms past us, the sound waves get stretched out and have a lower frequency. Edwin Hubble, yes, the same Hubble the well-known space telescope is named after, found that distant galaxies were moving away from us based on redshift observations, including that the universe must therefore be expanding. Scientists then started wondering, if the universe is always expanding, then at one point, mustn't it have been infinitely small? And thus, the Big Bang Theory was born. Of course, the history of the Big Bang is more complicated than this, and there are other pieces of evidence to support it. Another key piece of evidence to support it is cosmic microwave background radiation, or CMB, a kind of radiation spread uniformly across the universe, as far as we know, thought to be left over from the Big Bang. There are numerous other observations that also support the Big Bang theory. Why it's still just a theory. When it comes to space, and even science in general, our knowledge and understanding are constantly evolving. The Big Bang theory might seem to be very well supported, and although it is the best suggestion for the origin of the universe we can make based on current evidence, there's a lot we don't know about the universe that could disprove it. For example, dark energy and dark matter. Even if they're thought to make up most of the universe, we really have no idea what they are. Pretty much, we only know that they are not visible to our telescopes, and we are inferring that they exist based on the fact that our observations don't fully align with what would happen if only visible matter were present. So, as we learn more about these mysterious elements in our universe, we may discover the Big Bang Theory doesn't account for our new knowledge. And then, of course, there's the fact that we don't understand what existed before the Big Bang. If we figure that out, things could change a lot. Conclusion. Overall, the Big Bang Theory is just like any other theory. It's not a definitive fact like 1 plus 1 equals 2. Although some philosophers would agree, this isn't a definitive fact either. And it could be disproven. But this doesn't really make it any less valid. A lot of major theories change and evolve over time, and that makes perfect sense. It's completely logical that as we get more evidence, we change our perspectives. In fact, it's necessary that we change our perspectives. Otherwise, we end up trying to find loopholes to support outdated ideas. In the end, the Big Bang Theory reminds us that science isn't about having all the answers. It's about constantly asking better questions. Our next article from TeenVogue.com. Vivian Wilson on trans shooter myth. I'm not going to shoot anybody. I'm a model. This article was written by Ashley Carter on September 20th. Teen Vogue Special Edition cover star Vivian Wilson spoke at Teen Vogue Summit 2025, and she didn't hold back. In conversation with editor-in-chief Varsha Sharma and politics editor Lex McMenamin, Wilson discussed the chaos of New York Fashion Week, online harassment, and the right-wing myth that trans people are violent. The model got candid and emotional about her own experience as a trans woman and opened up about the attack on gender-affirming care and anti-trans bills being passed nationwide under the Trump administration. Wilson medically transitioned when she was 16 and said it basically saved my life. While on stage, she held back tears, saying, "I refuse to cry. I'm gonna mess up my makeup." There's this widespread misinformation and demonization where, especially right now, they're painting us all as violent mass shooters, Wilson said of the far right. "I'm not going to shoot anyone. I'm a model. I don't even know how to hold a gun." In Wilson's Teen Vogue cover story in March, she expressed wanting to model more. And in September, Wilson made her NYFW debut, walking in three different shows throughout the week. The model hit the runways at Prabal Gurung, Dauphinetta, and Alexis Bitar, creating buzz every step of the way. The Alexis Bitar presentation during Fashion Week was a theatrical show about the trans experience and the political attacks on trans rights. Wilson said she rehearsed for the show multiple times. Earlier this year, Wilson opened up to Teen Vogue about making an effort to support herself, despite her father being the richest man on earth. The model said she enrolled in community college in Los Angeles, noting, "College is expensive. I don't have that inheritance. I'm financially independent," Wilson said during Summit. "I'm making money now. Pre-Teen Vogue cover, no. People have a lot of assumptions, and you just kinda have to deal with that." As for her social media presence, Wilson doesn't care about being cringe and encourages more people to do what they want online. "My social media page is kind of me just doing what I feel like, and people watch it sometimes," she continued. "It's kind of just things that I find funny or entertaining." With the current political climate and the constant attack on LGBTQ plus rights, immigrant rights, and more, Wilson said she finds hope wherever she can. "What gives me hope?" she considered before answering. "My roommate's cat." We've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.